Welcome to episode number 63, Captivate.
This is the Rotated Views Podcast with Jimmy Lee and the crew, giving you life from various perspectives. Welcome to our level. We hope you enjoy the views.
All right, you are now tuned in to the Rotated Views Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Lee Velez. I'm here with Manny,
you,
Gabe, and special guest, Vanessa Van Edwards. This title is Captivate. In this episode, we have special guest, Vanessa Van Edwards. In this episode, we talk about her book, Captivate, and how she uses science to succeed with people. We get into various topics, including body language, parenting, enthusiasm, and emotional intelligence. Vanessa shares with us hacks for taking charge of interactions at work, at home, and in any social situation. Lastly, we wrap up the episode with quotes from the author herself, Vanessa Van Edwards. So, if you are new, thank you for listening. We drop a new episode every Tuesday morning for your listening pleasure. Don't forget to download and subscribe. We like to kick things off with a definition from dictionary.com. And appropriately so, we define the term captivate. And dictionary.com defines it as to attract and hold the attention or interest of, as by beauty or excellence, enchant. So, since we have a special guest, Vanessa Van Edwards, with us today, I want to actually, I normally ask someone to give us a bio, but I'm going to give this bio myself, and then I want her to kind of, add to it. So, Vanessa Van Edwards is a lead investigator at Science of People, a human behavior research lab. Her latest book, Captivate, was chosen as one of Apple's most anticipated books of 2017. She's fascinated by body language, leadership, and charisma, and writes about these topics for CNN, Fast Company, and Forbes. She also writes for a monthly column for Entrepreneur Magazine and the Huffington Post. Her innovative work has been featured on NPR, Business Week, and USA Today. More importantly, she's addicted to Sour Patch Kids, airplane coffee, and puppies. So, Vanessa, is there anything else our audience should know about you?
I'm also a recovering awkward person. So if anyone ever had a tremendously embarrassingly long awkward stage, I am your person. We will get along very well.
That's fantastic. And you are an author. So how did this all come about, from the Science of People, to Captivate and everything else in between?
Yeah. So I've always loved research and especially any kind of behavior psychology, neuroeconomics, all those amazing ideas. But the problem is I would read all the latest research from academic institutions or organizations, and they were these beasts of academic studies, right? They were, 20-page papers with academic jargon, and you could barely understand the abstract, let alone, all the statistical methods in the article. And I wondered, was there a better way? Was there a way to take the science that's being done out there and kind of turn it into applicable nuggets and maybe test it in the real world? Because the other problem is, with academic universities, their studies are really small sample sizes. Usually it's like 26 college seniors. And so we know a lot about psychology majors in Ivy League colleges around the world, right? Like we know a lot about that demographic.
Yeah.
But not so much in the big data world. So what we do is we try to test some of the academic research with big data. So I'll read a great study out of Tufts University or Harvard Business School and then see if I can turn it into an original research experiment with big data, with broad sampling of people, to see if we can expand upon the research at all. And that need or that desire is what sort of spawned our lab to start doing all this unique research.
That's so fascinating. So you're going from, the traditional study of exactly how you said, as universities, they gather just about, what's funny. I went to me and my cousin Manny here went to Temple University in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was totally one of those subjects. I remember I did it just for the money. It's like, yes. Oh, sweet. 50 yes. bucks. I was a broke college student.
Did you do any weird studies? Because I remember the psychology studies I did. Did you do any weird ones?
Oh my gosh. I remember them. Okay. So they walked me in a room one study was they walked me in a room, they sat me in a chair, then blindfolded me, and then asked me to, you know, what I was smelling as as they're like rapid fire asking me questions. So they wanted me to be aware of what, I guess, using two senses at once. I'm not sure. I don't even know what the result of the study was. I was happy to get my $50.
Was the smell good?
Yeah. So it was like, I got scared as soon as they say, tell me what you smell. I'm like, I didn't mean to be nervous. Yeah. No, it was, the first one was like a floral scent. I don't think I nailed what flower it was, but it was a floral scent. I remember there being like a food, which I thought was like French fry. It smelled like a French fry to me. Mm. And then the third one, it was like a cotton smell. So I'm assuming it was like a freshly washed t-shirt or maybe like a fabric softener sheet, something like that. And I was answering questions and I was blindfolded in a dark room. It was a very bizarre, I don't even know what they're trying to find, you know, what level of study this was. But I just remember just getting paid and being very happy.
No, that's so awesome.
It's interesting. I wonder, there's so many interesting studies on smell. One of my favorites, and I don't think it was the one that you were doing, but it might be close. This is one of my favorite studies on smell. So what they did is they blindfolded participants, most likely college freshmen or seniors. Yeah. They paid $50, which, by the way, my friend, $50, you made a killing. Like, that's pretty good pay. I think I only made $20 when I did my studies. So they take you in a lab, they blindfold you, they put you in a dark room, and they ask you to smell and taste different kinds of yogurt. And they ask you if you like the flavor and scent of that yogurt. Now, the trick about this is they ask you in a way that's very leading with the smell. So they give you yogurt and they say, please rate the strawberry-ness of this strawberry-flavored yogurt. And you give it a rating from 1 to 5. And then they do the same thing with chocolate yogurt and vanilla yogurt. The thing is it's actually all chocolate yogurt.
No way.
Your brain, if it thinks it's about to smell strawberry yogurt, will actually smell strawberry yogurt. And people rate the strawberry yogurt as a very strawberry flavor. And that's like, it shows the power of priming, which is this really powerful psychological concept that we actually create the environment that we think is going to happen as opposed to actually experiencing the environment as it is. So that's why presentation of food is so important. That's why presentation of your brand is so important, because if you think it's going to taste good, it's very likely that it will. But if you think it's going to taste bad, it's very likely that it won't.
That is fascinating beyond, you know, because we always talk about, you know, first impressions. I know it's kind of the same thing where, you know, the way you present yourself, she's saying the way we, you know, we lay out food, the presentation. But I remember seeing a study, I don't know what in the world I was watching. I couldn't sleep and just turned on the TV. And it was kind of something, you know, to that level where they were in France and they're doing a study. Apparently this restaurant was selling like the number one water in the world at the time. I don't know how long ago this was. And these people raved about how good the water tasted, right? So
I think I know where this is going.
Yeah. So they, you know, these guys thought they'd get a kick out of it. They're doing a study as well, and they would go, it might have been like Mythbusters or it was something like to that level. And they're doing a true investigation, you know, and a study. So they went to this restaurant and they filled the bottles of water with hose water and they served it to the people who are eating there. And then they interviewed, you know, them. So, you know, we're doing a study on the water. We just wanted to see, you know, what is it about this water? What did you think about it? And how did it taste? And, you know, the response like, oh, it's glorious. This is the best water I've ever tasted. You know, this is like God sent this to that level of enthusiasm. I mean, it blew their socks off and it was just hose water.
See, I actually really like these studies because for a lot of the my students, they're entrepreneurs, they're business people. And I tell them, you're not trying to sell, you know, hose water to people who are expecting glacier water. You're selling something that you think is really amazing. If you package it as it's as amazing as it is and you tell people how good it is and you learn how to sell yourself, you're actually setting people up to enjoy it as much as they should. So I think that there's like a level of authenticity there that, yes, of course, all these things can be used for evil, but I think there's also a way to use them for good in that you know, you are a great person, right? If you show up on a date and you want to present yourself well, that's because you are a great person. You are a great catch. And so it's not inauthentic to show up as your best version of yourself. It's just saying, I really take care in who I am, and I really feel like I'm giving you something that will be worth your time.
Yeah, that is huge too, especially in sales. We always say this about my uncle Ed, we call him the hustler, and I don't know if you know the term with someone's being a little extra. My uncle is extra in everything he does. So talking about priming people, if this guy is, invites you over to, for maybe a burger or a steak on his grill, and he's like, "Oh, let's have lunch. Come over." Okay. Well, while he's cooking the steak, he's telling you about the steak. Mm-hmm. So yes. where he bought it, why it's the best steak, mm-hmm. what his preparation, and it's been marinating all day. Just every level of, and he's going through the stages of the prep that mm-hmm. he did for this, to the to amount of flips that each steak gets and why. By the time you're eating it, I was like salivating. I could not wait to eat this steak. And in all honesty, it was a good steak, but like he sold me on it before I even I even digested it.
Yeah,
which is fat. He does it with everything though. So it's always a fun time at Uncle Ed's because he's so involved into everything he does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I like being, there's a concept that I teach called being an adder, not a subtractor, which is sort of this, kind of builds on your idea of like, giving a little, you said extra, right? That was the idea. Yeah. Like, I think that's kind of being an adder, because what you're doing is you're not just giving someone a steak, you're actually giving them the experience of the steak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, when you think about happiness, and like I did a whole set of research experiments on the science of happiness, because it's a topic that I think is an aspect of human behavior that we don't think about in terms of interactions or relationships. But happiness doesn't just come from being on a vacation, right? We think about taking a vacation to Hawaii, and it's 5 days out of the year, and you think that happiness is just on those 5 days. But actually, the experience of Hawaii before and after is where the real happiness comes in. It's buying your ticket. It's saving up for the trip. It's telling everyone that you're going there. It's getting your clothes laid out. It's thinking about how you're going to pack. Like every time that you think about Hawaii, it gives you a dose of happiness if you choose to look at it that way. So if you think about eating a steak, which is, it could take whatever, 10 minutes if you're eating a small steak, maybe 20 minutes if you're eating a big steak.
Right.
It doesn't have to be 10 to 20 minutes of happiness. It could be 2 hours of happiness, because if you prep that steak and you are lovingly seasoning it, and you ask the butcher, "Hey, where did this steak come from?" "Oh, it's grass-fed bison from the hills of Idaho." Great. And you take it home and you lovingly trim it. And then you add your favorite seasoning that you got from your grandmother's cabinet. And like you talk to your friends about it. Like that's 2 hours of happiness instead of just 10 or 20 minutes. And I think that that's a very, very different way to go about enjoying those small moments.
So that is fascinating. When you say that you can extend the level of happiness, now that I think about it, Uncle Ed is always smiling. Yeah. And I wonder, how people can apply that to the most mundane things, because in my mind, he even does it for like car repairs. Mm. I come over, I'm like, "Oh man, Uncle Ed, I got a light that just went off the truck." He goes, "Oh, let's see what it is." And he looks at it and he's like, "Oh, yo, let's get in the car. Let's get in the car. I know exactly what this is. I know exactly what this is. We'll go to AutoZone. You have to go to AutoZone. You don't know why you go to AutoZone? The other places, they might rip you off because they cut out AutoZone cuts out the middleman, and they're getting their prices for cheap." This dude went in a whole explanation as to why we should go to AutoZone. He's like, "All right, let's go." You know what I mean? And we're talking about fixing, maybe like a light bulb or something in the truck. It's with everything. So he definitely has that approach where he stretches out. Is there anything, because we always say he's extra, is there anything to, in your research that you find with someone's level of enthusiasm towards things?
Yeah. So there's a couple things that I just thought of there. So the first thing is the idea of adding ritual where there is no ritual. So for people listening, think about some of the small moments in your life that you either do daily or weekly that could be extended. They could be savored. Like, for example, almost every morning I make myself tea. Now, this was not much of a ritual before. I would sort of, grab a tea bag and throw it in the mug and hit my little kettle and just sit there quietly while it boiled, right? Like that was sort of the experience.
Right.
I was like, why does it have to be this way? So I decided to like get some like beautiful different bags of tea. I even bagged some of my own tea. I went to a little tea shop and I got a bunch of different flavors. I got one of these beautiful glass like steeping machines. It's like more than a machine. It's like a contraption that supposedly makes the best tea ever.
Yeah. Nice. You
know, I got like gorgeous ceramic mugs that my friends painted for me. And so now like in the morning, instead of doing it passively, I actually look forward to going to, I call it my tea bar.
Nice.
I go to my tea bar and like, it's no extra space. It was like a birthday gift for the glass contraption. But I would think about what are things in your life? Is it making your cup of coffee? Can you make it like get some nice syrups for your latte or, you know, upgrade your mugs or, you know, what are the different rituals that you can add? Because that really helps create happy moments or peak moments where it would have been a totally brainless autopilot neutral moment. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is there is definitely research about enthusiasm. So enthusiasm is an interesting one because it is a facet of personality. When you talk about personality, there's extroversion. Enthusiasm can be a facet of extroversion. So I'm guessing that your uncle is quite extroverted. Is that right?
Yeah. Understatement.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they typically go hand in hand, not always. I do know some enthusiastic introverts, but you usually call an introvert passionate as opposed to – or dedicated as opposed to enthusiastic because they are less verbal and less sherry. Sherry is not an adjective, I know. But like, you know, they get very excited about it for themselves. They're not necessarily going to go walk around a party with it. It's an interesting one because it's actually somewhat genetic. About 30 to 55% of our personality is genetic. So it's usually coded. But the other aspect of enthusiasm from a social interaction standpoint is called capitalization. So capitalization is when someone comes to you enthusiastic about something. It could be a steak or AutoZone or their bar or whatever it is. And they are coming to you with a bid. They want you to take their enthusiasm and either be curious about it, so ask questions, or match it, so get as enthusiastic about it as them. The worst thing that could happen for an enthusiastic person is for them to come to you with enthusiasm and have it be met with a dream killer. Mm. So a dream killer. And this is, I think, a big thing for parents with children. Children show a lot of enthusiasm before their personality is even fully developed. Even introverted children can be enthusiastic about certain things. And usually the first person they want to share it with is their parents. Mm. And so because parents have seen everything a million times before and we know it all, right?
Yeah.
It can be very tiresome to show that kind of enthusiasm back or to show any kind of curiosity. And so what we have to keep in mind is the greatest gift we can give enthusiasm is a match or curiosity of that enthusiasm. The worst thing we can do is meet it with neutrality. Neutrality is like a wet blanket for passion or enthusiasm, or start to dream kill it. I'll give you a very specific example. So one of the things that I'm very enthusiastic about is s'mores. I love it. I am a cultivator of s'mores. I try different versions of s'mores. I have like, whenever I have a party, I have an outdoor deck and we do s'mores. I have like a s'more buffet. Like we do like lots of different kinds of s'mores. Okay.
Nice.
So I'm like very into it. And like everyone who knows me knows I'm into it. So the other day I was having a barbecue and people were coming over and I was like, and the s'more bar is open. And like I throw open the doors to the patio and you know, a rush of people go through. And also I get great joy out of seeing how people cook their s'mores. Like I have a whole theory of personality about like how people cook their s'mores and like do they burn their marshmallow and like it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's very fun. It's a very fun thing. So I had a woman who was at the party and she walks over and she's eyeing the s'more bar but not touching anything, which is never a good sign. Because I mean, if you see chocolate and marshmallows, the first thing you want to do is touch and eat.
Yeah.
And she's kind of looking and she turns to me and she goes, "What kind of marshmallows are these?"
What?
And I was like, so this is moderately curious. Okay, well, I'll take curiosity. Okay. So I said, you know, they're the marshmallows that like everyone buys at the grocery store.
Very specific.
I was like, they're not fancy marshmallows if that's what you mean. And she goes, "Oh, do you know that those marshmallows are made with a horrible kind of animal gelatin that is really terrible for?" And she like went on about how terrible this animal product was. Now,
buzzkill.
But yes, total yeah, exactly. Total. And I felt embarrassed. Right. I felt really, really embarrassed because here was a guest in my home who was vegan, and I really wanted to respect her way of eating. Like I was horrified that as a host, I had not only provided something that was going to give her a heart attack at a young age, right. according to her, but God. Also didn't respect her dietary restrictions, which as a host, you know, you should try to do. True. So I was so embarrassed and so sad, right? Mm-hmm. Like it immediately. And now when I have barbecues, I'm like, oh my God, like, do I have to get vegan marshmallows for people? So like it was this whole thing. And I think that there was another way that she could have approached that, right? Like, I'm totally down for asking questions. I'm totally down for educating people about this product because clearly this is not a good thing that they put in marshmallows. But there was probably a better way to do it that wouldn't have been such a buzzkill. And that's, I think, the difference between capitalizing or adding and subtracting.
So what reaction wouldn't have made you feel like the wet blanket? What would made you feel like, okay, and still enthusiastic and upbeat about the marshmallow bar or the s'more bar? After, you totally. Know, what comment would have been what you were looking for?
So what would have been amazing is if she could have started with something that was good. So maybe she loves chocolate. Maybe she loves graham crackers. Maybe she loves dessert. So that would have been nice. But she could have also just said, oh my gosh, look at this. I've never seen such a spread before. You have a couple different kinds of candy here. So I have a lot of different kinds of chocolate. Like I'll have like mini Snickers bars and mini and Reese's Pieces instead of chocolate, like to add to your s'mores because there's nice. Something better than different chocolate. So she could have said, wow, like look at all these different kinds of chocolates. Have you ever seen they have these really interesting different kinds of marshmallows? I've even seen this company in Portland and they're vegan too. And they have raspberry marshmallows. They have lime marshmallows. They're amazing. I bet you that would be like a crazy ad. Like I would love to bring over some next time I come over. Yeah. Then we could have had I would have had no idea. I would have been like, what? There's right. raspberry marshmallows? My, like, right? Like, it would have blown my mind. And I would have gotten excited and enthusiastic about buying vegan marshmallows for next time. Like, I think that would have been a very easy way of going about it. And she actually would have educated me on something because then she could have said, you know, most people don't even realize that marshmallows aren't vegan. And I would have been like, they're not vegan? Like, what animal products in them? And she'd have been like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it. When I first started to look into being vegan, I thought marshmallows would be no problem. And I looked at the back and there's this weird, she could have educated me on it in that way. Mm-hmm. Would have actually, I think, made it for fascinating party conversation in a certain sense.
Huh. Speaking of that's a great answer. But as you're giving that response, it reminded me, as you know, we're all here dads, and how many times do our kids come up to us, as you mentioned earlier, very excited about something, and since we quote know it all and seen it a million times, kind of shoot it down, and instead of being as matching their enthusiasm. I'm a very high energy person, so a lot of times I am matching his enthusiasm. My son James just came home from school and he just did it again. Yesterday we're in the pool all day and it's later, it's not time for that, mm-hmm. He just comes home, he's like, oh dad, he looks outside and sees the pool. Oh dad, can we go in the pool? And I'm staring at him like, no, we can't go in the pool, it's gonna be 8 o'clock at night. Totally just shot it down. He's staring, he's like, but I like the pool, like giving me like that little smart response back. But how many times as, parents really, not just dads, but we don't match the enthusiasm or that level of excitement, as our children, is there any tips maybe? Because sometimes it's hard because it's a lot of energy to handle. Sure. And yes, 5 minutes ago, I matched his energy. 10 minutes ago, I was excited as he was. By the 20th thing he brought up that he's excited about, I'm not excited. I'm done with the excitement. I just naturally, I'm just exhausted. So how do you maintain that?
I also think that it's really important to not be inauthentic with enthusiasm with your kids because that's a form of lying, right? Like, you don't want to be like pretend excited. Like anyone can tell the difference between a fake enthusiasm or like mocking enthusiasm. And I think so that's the first thing is it's much easier to find energy for things that you're actually excited about. Right. Because you're actually excited about them. And also that slowly teaches your kids what interests you. Like, for example, I don't have kids yet, but I just have a feeling that my husband is going to be the one into drones and airplanes and all those kinds of good things. We already have 5 drones in our house, and there are no kids in the house. where I might be more excited about like gardening and painting and drawing and music and those kind of things. I don't want to fake pretend. It's a lot more energy for me to fake pretending about his new car that he's working on, or like a drone that he's like playing with. That would take a lot more energy for me to be excited about that. Whereas if I say, "Whoa, like that's pretty cool. That reminds me of your dad. Did you show him?" Right? Like that's a different level of enthusiasm versus things that actually make me excited. So that's the first thing. I think that it takes a lot of energy to stick to things that you're actually excited about. The second thing is enthusiasm doesn't have to match their energy level. So it takes a lot of energy, obviously, to be as excited for a kid. When a kid's excited about something, they're excited with their entire body, right?
Like,
they're like jumping up and down and like, oh my gosh, I love watching kids get excited about things. I just got back from Disney World and my favorite part of Disney World was watching the kids enjoy Disney World. Like that was like 100%. I wasn't even there with kids, but like watching other kids experience things was like the best part. And so I think that you as an adult don't necessarily also have to jump up and down and, you know, scream with delight. You can also match that enthusiasm with curiosity. Mm-hmm. Curiosity and questions are a much lower energy form of still sharing enthusiasm. So asking questions is a way of also capitalizing on that enthusiasm.
I love that because you're also, you know, you're still showing interest into, you know, what you're not shooting them down. That's fascinating. And I want to also go back to what you were saying earlier about inheritance. I'm just like looking at my kid and my wife always says, he's a total Velez. Me and my brothers and my dad we're very high energy. We like to joke around, boys jumping off of things, you know, whatever. So I'm wondering, he seems to be, but he also has like her tendencies when when things happen and how we react back to what he's asking us, so to speak. So if he's super excited, I love being excited with him because that's like a natural thing for me. My wife's like a way more toned down, actually maybe the opposite, just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. And just holding in her excitement, or just not, you know, as you say, Sherry, as I am.
Or visibly excited.
You're visibly excited. Yeah. So maybe inside, obviously she's excited, but she's just not like the way I am. I'm like, oh, buddy, grab your bags. Let's go. Let's do it. So how do you guys know by any of the studies how that even works out? Obviously, it's inherited, but is there a way that people can manipulate it? Let's say if my mom was constantly, you know, as a pessimist, and I got that and I inherited being a pessimist and I didn't want to be a pessimist anymore. Is there ways people can manipulate their feelings to change for the better or what they would assume is better?
Yeah. So when we look at the science of personality, we're basically looking at 5 main personality traits. And this is the most reliable form of personality science. It's much more reliable than Myers-Briggs or DISC or Enneagram. Those have not really been backed up by academic research. The only academically viable set that's used across cultures, so universal personality science, is called the Big 5. So it's openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And so this is a huge chunk of the kind of middle part of my book, because what it is trying to figure out where someone naturally falls and then exactly what you just said, dialing up or down. So just because you might have inherited either being high or low in a trait, so you either are high, medium, or low in a trait, it doesn't mean that you can't change it. And this is called free trait theory. So free trait theory basically says that you can change, dial up or dial down your personality traits, your personality orientation based on your goals. So like a famous example would be Jackie Kennedy. So Jackie Kennedy was famously known as an introvert, but she had goals as first lady, goals to change things and bring style and grace to the White House. And so she dialed up her introvertness to become a little more extroverted and do TV appearances and public speaking and be a little bit on the campaign trail. That was, I don't according to her biographies, that was not natural to her, but she dialed it up. That's a very famous example of a way to do it. Another one would be Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was famously low on the agreeableness scale. So agreeableness is how you work with others. It's how cooperative you are, whether you default to yes or no. So people who are high in agreeableness default to yes. People who are low in agreeableness default to no. So he was famously low. He typically defaulted to no. He did not love working on teams. However, he dreamt very big. He knew that he could not build Apple without being on a team, without working with people, without getting help. So he had to dial up his agreeableness and find ways to work with people on a team to be able to get his ideas and goals through at Apple. So yes, 100% you can dial up or dial down. Can you flip your personality traits? Not really. Can you change them long term? Very hard, but you can dial up or dial down.
Fascinating.
I'd like to ask a question. When you talk about Ocean, this matrix, and in the book you talk about step one is figuring yourself out first. Is that the most important step? You can't go to step two without mastering step one. Is that true?
I would say it's not essential, but I prefer it. So you don't have to figure yourself out first, especially if you are stumped on yourself. You know what I mean? Like, I've had people tell me who are not quite as self-aware or have had a very complicated personal history. I've had them say, I actually had to solve everyone in my life first who then taught me about myself. So you don't have to. It just helps when you start with yourself to be able to see people in relation to you. But I think getting a grasp of the personality traits, like one of the things that I do in the book and I do it when I teach, is to think of the quintessential examples in each of the personality traits. So thinking of the quintessential examples is other people. So for example, like the quintessential example of low agreeable is probably Steve Jobs, maybe Elon Musk. The quintessential example of extrovert might be, actually, that's a good one for you guys. What do you think is who's the person, the celebrity you can think of who's just the most extroverted person you can think of?
Kim Kardashian.
Okay, great. Love it. Okay, so Kim Kardashian would be a great one.
Kanye West. That couple.
Yeah, yeah. Like, what are they called? Kimye?
Yeah, Kimye. Yep.
Why do I know that? So I do think in a certain sense that can also be helpful. So thinking about quintessential other people in your life might even be a backdoor into solving yourself.
Wow. Now, even tailing back, I hate to go back, but it just fascinated me when you're talking about inheritance, which made me also think of, we talk about IQ and EQ, the difference and the importance of both. We're talking about, are we all born with, just like an IQ, a set of, emotional intelligence that we can then build on? And is there any correlation between the emotional intelligence and intuition?
So you can be born with high PQ or interpersonal intelligence, but you do not have to be. So it's kind of like if you think about PQ like athleticism. So I don't like to compare PQ to IQ because actually it's very different. IQ, you can kind of be born with it. And it's hard to raise your IQ levels. But I like to think of it as athletes. So for example, if you are born with a certain kind of build, that is going to make you better set up for success in certain sports. So if you are of light, a man of light build, who's has a small posture, small stature, you might be ideal as a jockey, nimble, fast, lightweight, right?
Right.
You would be great as a horse jockey. Maybe you're born and you were already off the charts height-wise. You're above 6'5". You're a fast runner. You'd be great as a basketball player, right? So that sets you up for success. However, that does not mean that if you are of average height, you cannot be a jockey or you cannot be a basketball player. Could it affect the position that you play? Probably. Would it affect the amount of hours you have to put in the gym? Yes, definitely. So like me, for example, I was born with very little interpersonal intelligence. And so I had to spend extra hours in the gym, if you will, which I call my lab, studying how people work. I do not find conversations natural. So I had to study them. I had to hack them. That's why we have, human behavior hacks in the book. I believe that you have to learn the programming language of humans to be able to solve them. Because for me, I just was not born with that natural ability. So I think that if that answers the question, yes, there are those naturally charismatic people. People say that Bill Clinton was one of those people. I think he was probably born charming people, you know, out of the womb. And then there are others who had to learn it. But both are fair and viable and interesting.
So I know I'm a dad, right? And I always find it interesting that my son can pick up, you know, certain things without anything being said. So if he's sitting on my lap and we're watching, you know, the game or whatever, and he'll just like look up at me. I didn't say a word. And he'll just like, I love you, Dad, or whatever. And then he's like, you okay, Dad? And this kid's, he's three. So then I remember one time, he was walking from the entrance of our house into the kitchen. And I was sitting down, finishing up dinner. And I was just admiring who he was. I was just staring at him. I was like, oh my gosh, look how beautiful this child is. And I was walking up, and he's walking up towards me, and I'm smiling. He's smiling. And I said, I love you so much in my head. And I touched his, you know, like the back of his head, like to give him a kiss. And he's like, I love you too, Dad. So I'm like, but I didn't even say anything. So that's why I was always interested in like the intuitiveness of children. Are they more in tune with like emotions like that than we are? Or is it just something, I don't know, maybe it was just a random thing my kid did.
Or he's just telepathic.
Or he's, well, yeah.
He could be psychic. Right. I have not seen any definitive research saying that children are more intuitive than adults. However, there is quite a bit of research about how children are more emotive than adults. So I think that the study is that children on a day, in the average day, show an average of over, I think I want to say it's 200 body language gestures in the average day. By the time they reach high school, it's down to under 30 or something like that.
Wow, wow.
And I don't know if I have those numbers right there from my memory, but it's extreme. Basically saying that kids are much more expressive. Now, usually expressiveness or being emotive goes hand in hand with picking up on emotions and reading expressiveness. But through school or through being an adult or through behaving, they are taught or learned to hone them down and focus more on the verbal, that your verbal is more important. For example, you know, parents will often stick to the same three nonverbal lessons. They typically are make eye contact, look at me when you're speaking, right? Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. one yeah. of them. Yeah. The second one is stand up straight, sit up straight. So posture. And the third one is usually has to do with hands. So it's either shake his hand, you know, we always give a handshake, or put your hands underneath the table. Don't put your elbows on the table. Usually that's one of the three things. Those are only three of hundreds of body language laws and ways of expressing. But kids are taught hundreds, if not thousands, of verbal ways to express. So the lessons from parents on verbal expressiveness are tremendous. I mean, it's everything from say please and thank you to how do you talk to an adult to here's how to write an essay when you get into high school to here's how to form a sentence to here's the proper past tense, here's the proper future tense to here's how you say mom, maybe, here's how you say, right? Like the verbal lessons are pages and books and books and books, whereas the nonverbal lessons stop. It's really three. And so one of the goals that I have at my lab is the pro bono side of my business. So that what pays the bills are book sales and corporate trainings and our online courses. But the pro bono side, the nonprofit side, is I teach this in schools. So there are very, very few classes on nonverbal intelligence for kids. But actually they are fascinated by it, and they are much faster learners than adults, I will tell you. Mm. I've even done nonverbal intelligence workshops for kindergartners, and they are faster learners than my MBAs by far.
Wow.
So I think that's what we're talking about here is it's an inborn skill that we have, how to express, how to emote, and how to read those emotions, but we lose it because it's just not emphasized by our parents or by schools.
How much do you think is, and I'm thinking about it now, my kids, you know, I felt like my son at that same age would ask me those questions, and I didn't want him to know that either I was upset or how I was feeling. If I was down, if I was happy, obviously I was, you know, open about it, but I feel like sometimes I would just kind of squash his inquisition by being kind of that wet blanket. So I don't know, after time, are they just like kind of built to just be like, that emotion, I'm not going to ask. I know what that is. I'm just not even going to be open about it. You know, just kind of tune me out type thing.
Yeah. I mean, children, all adults, all people are constantly searching for good chemicals. And what I mean by that is we produce chemicals in interactions. So if we have a really loving, warm interaction, we produce oxytocin, which makes us feel belonging. So when we sit and we cuddle with our kids on the couch, or, you know, we have a really good, a great conversation with lots of eye contact, we're explaining something to our kids, that produces oxytocin. If we have a really stressful interaction with our kids or a neutral interaction, that might produce cortisol or adrenaline, which is the stress hormone. Kids who have experienced trauma or been bullied, they have a lot of cortisol in their little bodies, which is a very stressful thing. So our goal is to avoid the negative and seek out the positive. So if a child approaches a parent looking for either oxytocin, belonging, or serotonin, which is calming, so like soothe me, calm me down, or dopamine, which is pleasure, excitement, reward me, and they don't get it, they either get something neutral or they get cortisol, like, ugh, don't bother me right now, you know, either one.
Right.
They are taught from a chemical perspective to not try that again because either they're not going to get the chemical they want or they're going to get a bad chemical.
Huh. Makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So moving from, you know, being a child, obviously having children and dealing with certain situations, my brother is a single father. Is there anything that you can speak on when it comes to the atmosphere children are raised when it's that, you know, when it's that separated? So the way my brother operates and the way he kind of manages his life is totally different than the child's atmosphere when she's at home with her mother and her stepfather. Is there, you know, and my brother obviously sees her on the weekends and, you know, in the middle of the week. So when we're trying to build our children and not interfere with their growth, is there a tip you can have for him? I know he's not here, but I just found it, you know, curious. That is there something that can be, you know, like in an instant, you know, like a hack or something that, you know, that familiarity can be, or the comfort and soothing things over because it's the situation, it is what it is kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen any research on, again, I don't know, I'm not as familiar with the parenting, research that's out there. I haven't seen any research on, you know, single family homes, or, children who switch homes. However, I do think it's important to understand how our memories work. So when we're thinking about how we recollect experiences, so if you think back to your childhood, and I say to you, what were you doing at the age of 6 3/4? Wow. it would be very hard for you to remember that. Although at 6 3/4, you knew you were 6 3/4, right? You said I'm 6 and you held up your 3/4, right? Like that was a big deal.
True.
What we remember most, and this is the same thing in all kinds of social interactions, is typically the high or the low. Mm. And it is or. It is an or. Mm. So in a social interaction, and I talk about this, I was just on a wedding podcast recently, and I said, if you want to have a really memorable wedding, you should actually create, you should look at the psychology of your wedding by creating highs, because those are going to be more likely to be remembered. You want to make them beat any of the lows, like long bathroom lines or running out of food, or if it was really hot, you want to beat those. It's kind of the same thing with parenting, in the sense of if you have limited time with your child because they're switching houses. And by the way, this was me growing up. My parents got divorced when I was 3 years old, and I switched homes every Monday. So, until I was 18 years old, and it was miserable. It was really hard. However, I had limited time with my siblings in each home, and I had limited time with my parents. The moments I remember are the highs or the lows. I don't remember anything in between. So if your brother can create more highs at his house, and this doesn't necessarily mean like we're going to Disneyland every week.
Right, right.
but it does mean having these very small, very memorable moments. This can be having a really deep, enthusiastic conversation, or like having a theme every Saturday. I know this sounds kind of crazy, but I would have dad dates with my dad, where I didn't get these very often, but I probably remember almost all of them from age 4 through 12, where he would say to me, okay, like next daddy-daughter date, we're going to play checkers. I'm going to teach you how to play checkers, and we're going to get special chocolate from Moonstruck Chocolate, and we're going to learn how to play checkers with chocolate. Awesome. Like, I remember that so well. And it was like it was such a small thing, but we talked about it for weeks, and we would talk about the dates for weeks in advance. So thinking about how can you make those Saturdays or those, you know, times that he has with his children really memorable so that your child has something to look forward to, especially if they're having lows in their other home. They can at least have something to look forward to that's coming as a high to look forward to. So extending the happiness as well as a memory to look back on.
That is excellent advice. I love that. And I almost feel that on some level, just because of social media, we get to share our life and our lifestyles. And it is fascinating that you said that, because I do find my brother actually doing those little things. Like 2 weekends ago, they went, you know, like a kayaking or whatever. And then the following weekend, he's like, oh, and they went to the movies and they watched a specific movie that she wanted to watch. And he is talking to me. My brother's a barber. So he cuts everyone here's hair. So while we're sitting in the barber chair, you know, you go over, you know, what's going on in life, and he's almost priming me for what he's going to do with, you know, the fun that he's going to have with his daughter. So then it keeps me excited for the next time, you know, I talk to him. I was like, oh, did you and Ava go to, did you guys go kayaking? Yeah. Did you guys go fishing or whatever you guys were doing? That is fascinating.
Yeah. And I think surprises can be good, right. But actually the build up is even better, you know, and I don't know if his children are old enough to have cell phones, but, you know, texting and saying 4 more days until checkers, you know, nice. I just bought the board for us. Here's a picture. Get excited. You know, like that's a way of sharing enthusiasm. Even when your child's not with you, it's a way of creating a sense of connection and oxytocin and dopamine, even when they're not with you.
That's fascinating.
I have a question, and it's from the book, and you talk about with your dad in this particular experience of you would spend all this time trying to get him the best present. I don't remember if it was for birthday, Father's Day, or what have you. Yes. But you talk about, you know, how one time, one year you got sick, and you ended up just spending the day with him, literally eating chicken wings and watching football. And he had the greatest time ever in the book. If you want to kind of elaborate on that story, I thought it was a great story, because here you are trying to go above and beyond, and all he wanted you just sit down, watch some football, and just converse with him. It was great.
It's so funny that's one of my favorite stories. And my dad and I argued about it, by the way, which was really funny. Like I sent him a copy of the book, and that story is, I think, in chapter 8. And I was a little bit nervous for him to read it because, you know, I basically say that he hated all of my gifts growing up.
I'm not gonna lie, that's what it sounded like a little bit.
and he called me and he's like, I just read my story. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I did like some of your gifts. I was like, yeah, some of my gifts. Like 2 of them when like you picked them out with me, you know, like that right. we argued about it for a little while, like in a funny way. But yeah, I think that we don't realize that also our children have appreciation languages too. So, you know, I talk in that chapter about the 5 love languages or the 5 appreciation languages. And so learning what your child, how they feel love, and then your spouse, and then also teaching your child about the 5 appreciation languages is actually an incredible conversation. And they're very able to have that conversation with you. So I highly encourage everyone to ask their child about the 5 appreciation languages and teach them about it. And then maybe have a Saturday where you try different things and ask them what their favorite thing was, you know?
I love it. Absolutely love
it. That's
great. Yeah, so in Vanessa's book titled Captivate, she gives tons of tips when it comes from all over the map, from, you know, interactions from the first 5 minutes, first 5 hours to the first 5 days. The science of people, the lab, they've broken things down, literally down to a science, and the information that is revealed in the book is absolutely fascinating. If you hear the concepts that she's just delivering here in this short time that we have her, my mind, you know what they call it, like, my mind's getting blown every time, just thinking, I'm like, wow. And it's like leading to a bunch of other thoughts. That explosive thought process is, you know, delivered in her book Captivate. So like I said, the description, I want to kind of go over the description really quick if you're interested. Again, it's titled Captivate, Use Science to Succeed with People. And the question is presented, do you wish you could decode people? Do you want a formula for charisma? Do you know what exactly what to say to your boss, your date, or your networking partner? You need to know how people work. As a human behavior investigator, Vanessa Van Edwards studies the hidden forces that drive our behavior patterns in her lab, and she's cracked the code. In Captivate, she shares a wealth of valuable shortcuts, systems, and behavior hacks for taking charge of their interactions at work, at home, and in any social situation. These aren't people skills you learned in school. This is the first comprehensive, science-backed, real-life manual on human behavior and a completely new approach to building connections. So I know we only have you for a limited time, but for anyone out there is listening, can you just briefly explain what a human behavior investigator actually does?
Yeah. So we run original research experiments in real life. So I try to figure out how can we make shortcuts for ourselves in interactions, in conversation with charisma in our relationships to work smarter, not harder when it comes to relationships.
I love it. Awesome. So, all right. So perfect. So your book is now available. Where can people get the book?
Yeah, it's available wherever books are sold. Obviously on Amazon. Last time I checked, we hit the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. So we should be in your local bookstores, hopefully. We're even, I think, in a couple of airports. But Amazon is probably your safest bet.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice.
And congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks.
And what's the best way people can connect and contact you?
Yeah, so my lab is scienceofpeople.com, and I love when people come and play, so feel free to come and poke around. We have articles, you can take some body language tests, you can test out your reading of micro expressions and all kinds of good stuff, so scienceofpeople.com.
Yeah, and the website is packed with free tools to increase your social influence. It is, you know, exactly as she said, there's a lie detection test and, you know, it's fascinating stuff. We can go on for hours, but her new book, Captivate, as you heard, is available wherever books are sold. And with that being said, we like to wrap up each episode with quotes, and we're going to give you guys quotes from Vanessa Van Edwards herself. And the first one is, presence and personality matters just as much as ideas. And the second one is, the key to being a successful leader is meeting the needs of your subordinates, whether that's giving them encouragement or the independence to work alone. So there you have it, folks. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. You guys are great.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Captivate. In this episode, we have special guest Vanessa Van Edwards. In this episode, we talk about her book, Captivate, and how she uses science to succeed with people. We get into various topics, including body language, parenting, enthusiasm, and emotional intelligence. Vanessa shares with us hacks for taking charge of interactions at work, at home, and in any social situation. Lastly, we wrap up the episode with quotes from the author herself, Vanessa Van Edwards. Thanks again for joining us. Guys, don't forget to visit the website, jimmyleevelez.com. Follow the blog. If you have any inquiries or questions you would like for us to answer on a future episode, just email us at info@jimmyleevelez.com. And on behalf of myself and the rest of the crew, we wish you massive success. And until next time, adios.
The Rotated Views podcast was produced for self-development purposes. Thank you for the love and support. We truly do hope you enjoyed the views.